less than 6,000 years old, the cover makes one thing clear. People are very concerned about rising sea levels. Should they be? Are sea levels changing in response to our warming globe? And, even if our nation's monuments are safe for another 1,000 generations, are our human futures in danger as a result? As with precipitation, sea level is all about where the water is. After the oceans, the Earth's largest store of water is in the ice sheets on Greenland and the Antarctic. While many factors contribute to the small changes in sea level we observe over decades, its behavior over geological times depends most importantly upon how much ice is present on the land. Slow cycles, variations in the Earth's orbit and the tilt of its axis over tens of thousands of years, change the amounts of sunlight absorbed by the northern and southern hemispheres. As we've seen in Chapter 1, those changes have caused large swings in the global temperature over the past million years. But they also cause the ice sheets covering the continents to grow or melt. The intervals are technically called glaciations and interglacials, respectively, putting less or more water in the oceans, and so causing sea levels to fall or rise accordingly. Figure 8.1 shows geological estimates of the global sea level extending back more than 400,000 years. As you can see, the past half million years tell a story of repeating episodes in which sea level dropped slowly by about 120 meters, 400 feet, every 100,000 years as continental-scale glaciers built up, but then rose back up rapidly over about 20,000 years as the glaciers melted again. During the last interglacial, low ice, period, 125,000 years ago, known as the Eemian, sea levels were some 6 meters, 20 feet, higher than they are today. The last glacial maximum occurred about 22,000 years ago, when the continental glaciers started melting once again. The Earth today is in the Holocene interglacial, which geologists deem to have started about 12,000 years ago. According to the geological record, sea level has risen by about 120 meters, 400 feet, since the last glacial maximum, as rapidly as 120 millimeters, 5 inches, per decade, until about 7,000 years ago, when the rate of rise slowed dramatically. That's shown in Figure 8.2. So the question is not whether sea level is rising. It's been doing that for the past 20,000 years. Instead, what we want to know is whether human influences are accelerating that rise. Since human influences increased dramatically after about 1950, the best way to assess whether sea levels are going up faster than they would without us is to compare measurements since then with those in the more distant past. Shorter timescales mean smaller amounts of rise, so we'll need something more precise than the geological estimates we relied upon for the bigger picture. Luckily, some sea level records are available starting in the 18th century from tide gauges at ports in Europe and North America. Today, we have measurements from more than 2,000 tide gauges around the globe, and, starting in 1992, from satellite observations that use radar to measure the height of the ocean surface. To talk about the level of water in the ocean, climate scientists use the concept of global mean sea level, GMSL, which is inferred from measurements over the whole globe. Even though water seeks its own level, there are variations that are important given the fraction of a millimeter precision required. The GMSL is rising today at a rate of only a few millimeters per year. The height of the sea surface is affected by small differences in the Earth's gravity from place to place, by ocean currents, think of the lower water level in the swirl around a bathtub drain, by the temperature/salinity of the ocean, and even by the weather-dependent air pressure. As you can imagine, getting a clear picture of global sea level over the past century or so isn't easy, but even measuring the average sea level at some particular coastal location with a tide gauge isn't so simple either. You need to average out the waves every few seconds, the tides every 6 hours, and the changes from season to season. Over time, local sinking, subsidence, of the coast due to natural or human-caused changes in the water table can affect the elevation of the gauge, as can earthquakes and tectonic motion in general. For example, withdrawals of groundwater in the Houston-Galveston area over the past century have caused the ground to compact, lowering the land surface there by as much as 3 meters, 10 feet. And of course, there are all the usual problems caused by changes in instrumentation or observing protocols. But for better or worse, tide gauge data is what we've got, and some long and precise records are available, for instance, through NOAA. Determining the global mean sea level requires sophisticated analyses of tide gauge data from many different coastal locations, because just as the ocean isn't level across the globe, its rate of rise differs from place to place as well. For example, the local rates of rise along the U.S. coasts vary enormously due to local conditions. Eugene Island on the Gulf Coast is experiencing a rise of 9.65 millimeters, 0.38 inches, per year, while in Skagway, Alaska, the sea is retreating at a rate of 17.91 millimeters, 0.71 inches, per year. At least four independent groups have analyzed tide gauge data to determine the global mean sea level over more than a century. The results of one such analysis are depicted in Figure 8.3. They show that the GMSL was rising at the end of the 19th century, well before there were significant human influences on the climate, and since 1880 risen by some 250 millimeters, 10 inches, for an average rate of 1.8 millimeters, 0.07 inches, per year. The average rate of rise over shorter periods has fluctuated. For the past three decades, it's been about 3 millimeters, 0.12 inches, per year. In the context of the Earth's hydrological cycle, these are small numbers. 3 millimeters of sea level rise per year is roughly 0.3% of the planet's annual precipitation, so it's not surprising that there are variations from decade to decade. As mentioned earlier, global sea level has also been measured by satellite since late 1992. In satellite altimetry, a satellite measures its height above a broad patch of the ocean using radar. If the position of the satellite is known precisely, the height of the sea surface can then be determined. Today, radar altimetry provides essentially continuous global coverage of the open ocean, complementary to the coastal measurements of tide gauges. Four independent groups analyzed the data from the 11 satellite altimeters that have flown so far. It's quite a feat to measure the average ocean height to fractions of a millimeter from a satellite 600 kilometers, 370 miles, above the surface, and to do so consistently for decades. After some years of refinement, identifying corrections for things like drifts and satellite orbits, results such as those shown in Figure 8.4 from the NOAA group have emerged. As measured over 27 years by this series of satellites, the global mean sea level shows a clear seasonal cycle, ups and downs of about 7 millimeters, or 0.2 inches, superimposed on an average rate of rise of 3.0 plus or minus 0.4 millimeters, 0.12 plus or minus 0.02 inches, per year. So for the past three decades, sea level has been going up by about 3 millimeters, 0.12 inches, each year, higher than the overall average rate, 1.8 millimeters, or 0.07 inches per year, since 1880. To judge how the rate of sea level rise might have increased under growing human influences, IPCC's AR5 presents a figure, reproduced as Figure 8.5, that displays year-by-year 18-year trends, rates of rise, and their uncertainties from three different tide gauge analyses, as well as the 18-year trend in the satellite data then available. Each year's plot point is the trend over the 18 years that follow. The single point for satellite data plotted in 1994 therefore reflects the average over the interval from 1994 to 2011. While the rate in more recent decades is indeed higher than the average rate over the 20th century, it has to be viewed in context with a substantial variability over past decades, which is evident from even a glance at Figure 8.5. As the IPCC put it, it is very likely that the mean rate of global averaged sea level rise was 1.7, 1.5 to 1.9 millimeters per year between 1901 and 2010, and 3.2, 2.8 to 3.6, millimeters per year between 1993 and 2010. It is likely that similarly high rates occurred between 1920 and 1950. In fact, the rate of rise between 1925 and 1940, a period almost as long as the 18-year satellite record then available, was almost the same as that recent satellite value, about 3 millimeters, 0.12 inches, per year. Since the rate varies so much, it's hard to know for recent years what's human-caused and what's natural. And while the IPCC's 2019 Special Report on the Oceans and Cryosphere in a Changing Climate, or SROCC, expresses high confidence that the satellite data from 1993 to 2015 shows an acceleration, that is, the rate of rise is increasing, the implications are murky, both because of the shortness of the record and because there was acceleration well before human influences were significant. The AR-5 had this to say. It has been clear for some time that there was a significant increase in the rate of sea level rise in the four oldest records from Northern Europe starting in the early to mid-19th century. The results are consistent and indicate a significant acceleration that started in the early to mid-19th century, although some have argued it may have started in the late 1700s. When a draft of the CSSR was released in August 2017, I read it carefully, as did many other independent scientists, and immediately identified various problems and misrepresentations, several of which we've already discussed in previous chapters. I considered raising some of these issues directly with the report's authors, but I also wanted to make a broader point that had become clear to me, that whether or not the climate itself was broken, the assessment report process clearly was. I decided to publish an op-ed calling out one of the more egregious misrepresentations in the CSSR to highlight an example of the kind of thing that showed the need for a more rigorous review. I did just that right after the CSSR was formally published in November 2017, and the example I chose was sea level rise. Although decade-by-decade changes in the rate of sea level rise over the past century are central to untangling the effect of human influences from natural influences, the recent assessment reports, the CSSR and the IPCC's 2019 SROCC, hardly mention them. There are no graphs like Figure 8.5, where it's very easy to see how that rate changes, sometimes dramatically, over decades. Rather, the reports are filled with graphs of the rising sea level itself, such as Figures 8.3 and 8.4, from which it's almost impossible to judge the variations in, and significance of, how quickly sea level is going up. All of the assessment reports have plenty of text emphasizing that the rate of sea level rise in the past two decades is higher than the average of the 20th century. For example, the CSSR offers this on page 16 of its executive summary. Global mean sea level, GMSL, has risen by about 7 to 8 inches, about 16 to 21 centimeters, since 1900, with about 3 of those inches, about 7 centimeters, occurring since 1993. Very high confidence. That statement was a red flag for me, because it compares the rise over the past 20 years with that over more than a century. The fact that 3 of the 7 inches of rise since the dawn of the 20th century occurred in the past 25 years does indeed seem alarming, but suddenly less so if you know that it also rose almost as much, 6 centimeters as opposed to 7 centimeters, in the 25 years between 1935 and 1960. The CSSR makes no mention of that at all, even though its primary reference for sea level rise describes variability like that shown in Figure 8.5. The rate of rise over the most recent 25 years should be compared to that over other 25-year periods to understand just how significant the recent rate is. When I made that point way back in my 2014 Wall Street Journal op-ed, I was criticized roundly. Here's one example. He, Kunin, claims that the rate of sea level rise now is no greater than it was early in the 20th century, but this is a conclusion one could draw only through the most shameless cherry-picking. In reality, according to the data, the sea level trend was 0.8 millimeters of rise per year from 1870 to 1924, 1.9 millimeters per year from 1925 to 1992, and 3.2 millimeters per year from 1993 to 2014, i.e., the rate has actually quadrupled since pre-industrial times. Notice that the historical intervals cited are 54 years, 1870 to 1924, and 67 years, 1925 to 1992, while the recent interval, 1993 to 2014, is 21 years. This disingenuously obscures the higher rates in the 20 years from 1925 to 1945, which can be seen quite clearly in Figure 8.5. In the spirit of fruit metaphors, I wasn't cherry-picking, but rather comparing apples to apples. And, at any rate, I was only quoting what the IPCC itself said. The CSSR, on the other hand, follows the lead of some prominent climate scientists in hiding the large fluctuations in the rate of sea level rise over the past century, presumably because they make the past three decades seem less unusual. The report misleads by omission in not mentioning either the strong decadal variability of sea level rise during the 20th century or the fact that the then most recent values of the rate were statistically indistinguishable from those during the first half of the 20th century. Before publishing the op-ed pointing this out, I sent a more technical discussion of the issue to Don Wubbles of the University of Illinois, the CSSR's senior lead author, and to Robert Kopp of Rutgers University, the main author of the CSSR chapter on sea level rise. Both agreed that my criticism was valid. On October 15, 2017, email to me from Kopp read, in part, "I think the point about interdecadal variability is a useful one, and had it come during the public review period for the draft, I'm sure it would have been taken into account." Both Kopp and Wubbles said that I was the first to raise the point, surprising since the problem is elementary and many eyes had already been on the draft. Both also said that they would have added a discussion of sea level rise variability in the 20th century, but that it was then too late. The draft was in final copy edits, and the report was already too long. That last was another surprise, given the length already and how little space it would have taken to fix the problem. Wubbles also said he'd see about including text in the second part of NCA 2018 that would remedy the omission. I've not been able to identify any such text in the released version. To be clear, sea levels do rise as the globe warms. When the Earth's surface temperature increases, land ice melts, and as oceans warm, the water in them expands. Levels rise and fall seasonally, over the longer term in response to the orbital cycles we discussed earlier, and in response to other natural or human influences. While rates of rise over the past century have had significant ups and downs, a warming globe does indeed put more water into the oceans. What, then, of future sea level rise? The answer largely depends upon how much of the ice on the land melts as temperatures increase, together with the expansion of the warming oceans. Insights into why the rate of sea level rise has changed during the past century come from a recent paper that successfully closed the sea level rise budget. Scientists have struggled in recent years to balance that budget, that is, to reconcile the observed rise in sea levels with what is known about the various factors contributing to it. The new work tallies all of the observed changes since 1900 in land ice, Greenland, Antarctica, and mountain glaciers, and in liquid water stored on the land in aquifers and behind dams, and combines them with estimates of the thermal expansion of the ocean. The paper then compares those contributions with changes in sea level, as measured by tide gauges and satellites. The results are shown in Figure 8.6. The top panel shows how mountain glaciers, land water storage, and the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets have each contributed to changes in the global sea level. There are a few surprises here, given that the globe has warmed since 1900. The contribution from glacier melting has slightly declined since 1900, and is the same now as it was 50 years ago. The contribution from Greenland went through a minimum around 1985, and is now no higher than it was in 1935. And changes in terrestrial water storage were an important, negative, contributor during the flurry of dam building in the 1970s. So future global sea level rise is uncertain, not only because of all of the model uncertainties in the global temperature rise discussed in Chapter 4, but also because the dynamics of the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets are quite uncertain. The IPCC summarizes the situation. SMB is the surface mass balance, measuring the net change in ice due to atmospheric processes. For periods prior to 1970, significant discrepancies between climate models and observations arise from the inability of climate models to reproduce some observed regional changes in glacier and GIS, Greenland ice sheet, SMB around the southern tip of Greenland. It is not clear whether this bias in climate models is due to the internal variability of the climate system or deficiencies in climate models. For this reason, there is still medium confidence in the ability of climate models to simulate past and future changes in glaciers' mass loss in Greenland SMB. Nevertheless, the report offers projections of global mean sea level rise under the various emission scenarios discussed in Chapter 3. Under RCP 2.6, the most emissions-light scenario, which has global emissions vanishing in the latter half of this century, the IPCC projects levels will rise 0.43 meters, with a two-thirds chance of the value being between 0.29 and 0.59 meters, over the 21st century, while for the extreme, emissions-heavy RCP 8.5, The projected rise is 0.84 meters, two-thirds likely value between 0.61 and 1.10 meters. These projections correspond to average rates of rise of 4.3 and 8.4 millimeters per year, respectively. Both rates are significantly larger than the current 3 millimeters per year, though less than the maximal rate shown in Figure 8.2 of 12 millimeters per year 9,000 years ago at the peak of ice sheet melting. More importantly, these projections depend upon the dubious climate models we've discussed and their shaky grasp of the changes in the Antarctic and Greenland ice sheets that account for the bulk of sea level rise. Whatever the future changes in the global average, local sea level is what matters for planning adaptation measures, and in the coastal places that matter most to humans, it's been measured far longer and more accurately than global values. Local sea level rise is related to global rise, but it differs because of local factors like land motion due to tectonics or subsidence and changes in ocean temperatures and currents. Nevertheless, the climate models offer projections, however imperfect, for various cities around the globe under the various emission scenarios. These projections are even more uncertain than those for global sea level. It's easier to project average changes in the global ocean heat content than specific spatial variations in temperature and changes in local effects like currents. At the World Climate Research Program said in 2017, "Despite considerable progress during the last decade, major gaps remain in our understanding of past and contemporary sea level change and their causes, particularly for prediction/projection of sea level rise on regional and local scales. These uncertainties arise from limitations in our current conceptual understanding of relevant physical processes, deficiencies in our observing and monitoring systems, and inaccuracies in statistical and numerical modeling approaches to simulate or forecast sea level." The need for such caveats becomes clear when you compare the projections with the historical data. As an example, Figure 8.7 shows the monthly mean sea level anomaly, corrected for seasonal variation, at the tip of Manhattan, which has been measured by the Battery Tide Gauge, referenced at the beginning of this chapter, for more than 160 years. The solid line shows the average behavior, while the two arrows show the rate of rise between 2020 and 2100, projected in the AR5 under two different RCP scenarios. The long-term rate of rise is 2.87 plus or minus 0.09 millimeters per year, not very different from the 3 millimeters per year rate of rise seen in the GMSL over the past few decades. The AR5 gives projections of New York City sea level rise from 2000 to 2100 that range from about 550 millimeters, 22 inches, to 800 millimeters, 31 inches, as the scenarios range from RCP 2.6 to RCP 8.5. Uncertainties in each projection are about plus or minus 300 millimeters, 12 inches. But, as I mentioned, graphs of the sea level itself, rather than the rate at which it's rising, can be deceptive, and, in any event, we've got to take the long-term view. Figure 8.8, which shows the rate of rise for the Battery sea level over the past century, should calm any sense of alarm. Each year's point reflects the trend during the 30 years preceding it, making this an excellent way to evaluate the big picture of the trend in sea level rise. You can see that the rate has varied a lot over the past century, from lows of less than 2 millimeters, 0.08 inches, per year in the 30 years before 1930 and 1990, to highs of almost 5 millimeters, 0.2 inches, per year in the three decades before 1955 and 2015, even as it's averaged about 3 millimeters per year over the whole century. The records of other tide gauges along the U.S. Northeast coast also show this 60-year cycle, which is in sync with the Atlantic Multidecadal Oscillation, AMO, discussed in Chapter 4. So it's reasonable to expect that the rate will decline again during the next few decades. The average rates projected by the IPCC, on the other hand, even the low RCP 2.6 rate of 5.5 millimeters per year, would be so unusually high that they would fall outside the scale of this chart. The next few decades will tell. The media is as confused about the state of local sea level rise as the models are. For example, a recent article about sea level rise on Oahu, Hawaii, had dramatic pictures of flooding over the past few years and showed maps of which areas of Honolulu would be inundated if the sea level rose 30, 60, or 100 centimeters above the current level. but it failed to mention that the NOAA tide gauge record for Honolulu shows an average rate of 1.5 millimeters, 0.06 inches, of rise per year since 1905, meaning that, absent some very dramatic acceleration, it would take 200 years to achieve even the lowest mapped rise of 30 centimeters, 1 foot. Omitting that kind of context is, unfortunately, even more common in media coverage than it is in the assessment reports. In summary, we don't know how much of the rise in global sea levels is due to human-caused warming and how much is a product of long-term natural cycles. The CSSR and other assessment discussions of sea level rise omit important details that weaken the case for the rate of rise in recent decades being outside the scope of historical variability and hence for attribution to human influences. There's little doubt that by contributing to warming, we have contributed to sea level rise, but there's also scant evidence that this contribution has been or will be significant, much less disastrous. Humanity's tendency to construct cities near coasts has made rising waters a threat since ancient times, and insurance companies believe sea level rise is one of the major risks associated with a changing climate. The nature and extent of that risk, however, are still very much up in the air. Solving a problem ideally begins with understanding its cause and what actions we can take to affect it. The message put forth that human-caused warming is the sole source of rising sea levels gives the impression that reducing emissions is a solution. Alas, because ice melting lags behind warming, and also because of the persistence of CO2 discussed in Chapter 3, even if we were the culprit and ceased all emissions tomorrow, global sea level would continue to rise. What's more, as we've seen, local sea level changes and their effects are far more complicated still, involving ocean currents, erosion, weather patterns, and land use and composition. Clear and unbiased communication of these nuances is essential. If sea level does become a serious threat in coming decades, there's no doubt that we'll be better prepared, having devoted resources to further research and adaptation, unlikely to be a priority if we insist we already know all the answers. 9. Apocalypses That Ain't. The media, and hence popular and political opinion, attribute all manner of impending societal catastrophes to human influences on the climate, including death and destruction, disease, agricultural collapse, and economic ruin. Luckily for us, the historical data doesn't support such claims, and projections of future impacts, exemplified by the familiar "could be as bad as," stem from implausibly extreme scenarios fed into models that, as we've seen, are clearly not up to the task. But to understand just how badly the science is misrepresented when it comes to such impacts, you really need to see the details of a few examples. This chapter offers three vignettes of headline Apocalypses That Ain't. One is Climate-Related Deaths, a menace based on speculation, strained assumptions, and incorrect use of data. The second is a future agricultural disaster that is belied by the evidence and requires acrobatic distortion to even detect. And the third is purportedly enormous economic costs, which turn out, even based on the data presented, to be minimal, if not too small, to measure. I first met Michael Greenstone during my time in the Obama administration when he was leading an interagency effort to determine the economic impact of greenhouse gas emissions. Our paths have crossed a few times since. Greenstone is now the director of the Energy Policy Institute at the University of Chicago, and I found him an astute and careful energy economist. In 2019, Michael testified to Congress about some of the findings of his ongoing research into the economic effects of local and global changes in climate. The increase in the global mortality rate due to climate change-induced temperature changes in 2100 is larger than the current mortality rate due to all infectious diseases. We estimate the full mortality risk due to climate change to be an additional 85 deaths per 100,000 in 2100. Let's break down those numbers. In 2018, all infectious diseases globally accounted for about 75 deaths per 100,000, about one-tenth of total deaths from any cause, which have an annual rate of 770 per 100,000. Since the global population is about 8 billion, that amounts to 6 million deaths each year from infectious diseases. So if future temperature changes were to cause at least as many additional deaths, that would indeed be a very big deal. To set a scale for these numbers, U.S. COVID-related deaths in 2020 amounted to 100 per 100,000. Globally, the rate was 23 per 100,000, or one-third the rate from all infectious diseases. Evaluating Greenstone's alarming assertion means asking some questions. In particular, what are the current numbers of climate-related deaths? And how have climate-related deaths trended over the past century? More basically, you might be wondering, what's a climate-related death in the first place? Well, people don't die from climate. Climate changes slowly, and societies largely adapt to that, or migrate. But people do die from climate-related weather events, droughts and floods, storms, temperature extremes, and wildfires. We've already seen that it is far from certain that changes in climate have already increased these phenomena, but let's start by looking at the record of weather-related deaths over the past century. The Center for Research on the Epidemiology of Disasters, CRED, within the Université Catholique de Louvain, maintains an emergency events database covering over 22,000 mass disasters globally, starting from 1900. Data on deaths due to natural disasters are easily downloaded from that site and can be separated into those that are weather-related, droughts, floods, storms, wildfires, and extreme temperatures, and others that are not, earthquakes, tsunamis, and volcanoes. While there are large year-to-year fluctuations in those counts because of particular events, and deaths in the early years have been underreported, some sense of the trends can be had by looking at averages over each decade, as shown in Figure 9.1. One takeaway from this graph is that weather-related death rates fell dramatically during the past 100 years, even as the globe warmed 1.2 degrees Celsius, 2.2 degrees Fahrenheit. They're about 80 times less frequent today than they were a century ago. That's largely due to better tracking of storms, better flood control, better medical care, and improved resilience as countries have developed. A recent UN report confirms the trend over the past two decades. A second point is that in the most recent decade, extreme temperatures caused 0.16 deaths per 100,000 each year, about 500 times smaller than Greenstone's projection for 2100. So how did Greenstone come up with his alarming prediction? In further testimony, Greenstone provided some details of those findings from a paper that had just been published. The analysis uses historical records to understand how temperatures influence deaths, and then combines that with climate model projections of temperatures to estimate deaths in 2100. This is done over 24,378 different geographical regions, accounting for differences in their current climates, incomes, and age distributions. The researchers also claim to have at least partially accounted for future economic development and adaptation to higher temperatures. As the research paper, but not the coverage of Greenstone's testimony, acknowledges, the analysis is fraught with assumptions and uncertainties. In fact, the authors note that our full set of estimates reveals a remarkable degree of uncertainty, at least some of which is fundamentally unresolvable. Even apart from the economic and demographic dimensions, as we've seen in Chapter 4, there are great uncertainties in both the temperature changes the models project and in the emission scenarios used to drive them. It turns out that the 85 deaths per 100,000 in 2100 quoted with great confidence in Greenstone's 2019 testimony is actually the average value under the implausibly high emission scenario RCP 8.5, with an 80% probability of the value lying between minus 21 and 201. So Greenstone begins his testimony by taking an unrealistic, extreme scenario as his starting point. According to his own model, under the far more plausible RCP 4.5 scenario, the average death rate shrinks sixfold from 85 to 14, with a very wide probable range between minus 45 and 63. In other words, under that mid-range scenario, there's a good chance that deaths would actually decrease. There are other reasons not to place much confidence in these results. A crucial measure of a model's credibility is its ability to reproduce the past. That is, if the model were run using only the data we had as of, say, 1980, how well would its projections match the number of deaths that actually took place in the subsequent 40 years? Such hindcasting is an important test of the climate models themselves. but that basic check is absent from Greenstone's analysis. Without it, the results require an even greater helping of salt than the climate model projections they're built upon. Creating alarming headlines through highly uncertain projections of the future is one thing, but promoting the specter of climate-related deaths by distorting existing data is quite another. A 2019 article in Foreign Affairs by the Director General of the World Health Organization, Tedros Ghebreyesus, was entitled, "Climate Change is Already Killing Us." Yet the text doesn't deliver on the catchy title. Astoundingly, the article conflates deaths due to ambient and household air pollution, which cause an estimated 100 per 100,000 premature deaths each year, or about 1/8 of total deaths from all causes, with deaths due to human-induced climate change. The World Health Organization itself has said that indoor air pollution in poor countries, the result of cooking with wood and animal and crop waste, is the most serious environmental problem in the world, affecting up to 3 billion people. This is not the result of climate change. It's the result of poverty. That pollution does indeed affect the climate. As we've seen, the aerosols are actually a cooling influence. But pollution deaths aren't caused by a changing climate. It's the pollution itself that kills. Such brazen misinformation by the WHO's leadership is particularly upsetting for its potential to diminish confidence in the organization's vital public health mission. In August 2019, the New York Times ran the headline, "Climate Change Threatens the World's Food Supply," United Nations warns. The article announced the release of the summary for policymakers of the IPCC's Special Report on Climate Change and Land, SRCCL. The Times' description of the report's findings followed the standard template for such coverage. It's already bad. Climate change is already hurting the availability of food because of decreased yields. It's going to get a lot worse. If emissions of greenhouse gases continue to rise, so will food costs. But we can take prompt and drastic action to avert the worst. There is still time to address the threats by making the food system more efficient. By now, I trust that reading this litany of woe naturally raises the familiar questions about historical context and what the data shows. What have agricultural yields been doing in recent decades? Have they already been impacted? And if so, how? What exactly do projections of future catastrophes say, and how solid are they? Answering these questions requires careful reading of the IPCC special report itself. The SRCCL's key finding, A.1.4, says, "Data available since 1961 shows the per capita supply of vegetable oils and meat has more than doubled, and the supply of food calories per capita has increased by about 1/3. High confidence." That's supported by data in the report's technical summary, which shows that global production of both crop and animal calories has gone up dramatically since 1960, and that beginning in 1965, more than enough food calories have been produced every year to satisfy humanity's nutritional requirements. Indeed, annual deaths due to famine have averaged about 2 to 4 per 100,000 since 1980. The rate was 10 to 20 times larger in the first half of the 20th century. That's not to say hunger is no longer an issue. Poverty and problems with food distribution are among the factors leaving about 10% of the global population still undernourished, and the same key finding mentioned above notes that about 1/4 of the food produced is lost or wasted. But we do have the ability to feed all of humanity, and that ability stems largely from improvements in crop yields, such as those shown in Figure 9.2. In the 50 years from 1961 to 2011, global yields of wheat, rice, and maize, corn, have each more than doubled, and U.S. corn yields have more than tripled. Crop yields depend upon several factors: plant genetics, nutrients available in the soil, agricultural practices, and the weather manifestations of climate, temperature, insolation, and rainfall. But you might be surprised to learn that the increasing concentration of carbon dioxide has been a significant factor in yield improvements, as it boosts the rate of photosynthesis and alters plant physiology to use water more efficiently. Increasing CO2 in the atmosphere has also fertilized the natural world. As the SRCCL notes in its key finding A.2.3, during the past 4 decades, the leaf area index, the fractional area covered by leaves, observed by satellites, has increased markedly, greened, over 25 to 50% of the vegetated areas of the globe, while it has decreased, browned, over less than 4% of the globe. Despite the yield improvements over the past decades, the SRCCL makes the following claim. Climate change between 1981 and 2010 has decreased global mean yields of maize, wheat, and soybeans by 4.1%, 1.8%, and 4.5%, respectively, relative to pre-industrial climate, even when CO2 fertilization and agronomic adjustments are considered. Uncertainties, 90% probability interval, and the yield impacts are -8.5% to +0.5% for maize, -7.5% to +4.3% for wheat, and -8.4% to -0.5% for soybeans. For rice, no significant impacts were detected. This study suggests that climate change has modulated recent yields on the global scale and led to production losses, and that adaptations to date have not been sufficient to offset the negative impacts of climate change, particularly at lower latitudes. In other words, although the actual wheat yield went up by about 100% from 1981 to 2010, it would have gone up even more, 104%, if there hadn't been any human-caused changes in the climate. Similarly, the maize yield would have gone up by 77%, instead of by 70%. Unfortunately, it's far from simple to judge how, and by how much, yields have been affected by human-caused changes in the climate. You need to know both what the climate would have been absent human influences, and how agriculture was affected by those differences. In other words, we'd need to do a counterfactual analysis, one that can never be tested against observations. Aside from the acknowledged limitations of the methodology and the climate and crop models used to make those estimates above, the impacts they came up with are pretty small, comparable to the precision with which yields are measured in the first place. Data from the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization have a sampling precision of no better than 3%, among other uncertainties. As for catastrophes to come, the IPCC's report contains plenty of qualitative warnings of future food problems, many based upon the dubious climate projections discussed in Chapter 4. Among them are a concern that crops grown under elevated CO2 and significantly higher temperatures will have about 10% lower nutritional value, which the report notes could be mitigated by changes in crop genetics. But saying yields will be impacted is pretty meaningless, if not misleading, unless one also says by how much. Alas, it's tough to find any quantitative projections of future yields in the SRCCL. However, the report's key finding, A.5.4, has this to offer for a middle-of-the-road future scenario in which development follows historical trends. Global crop and economic models project a median increase of 7.6%, range of 1 to 23%, in cereal prices in 2050 due to climate change, RCP 6.0. leading to higher food prices and increased risk of food insecurity and hunger. Medium confidence. That's a remarkable statement, not just for what it says, but for what it's about. Prices, not yields. Prices for food commodities are set in global markets by the balance of two large numbers, supply and demand, and small changes in one or the other can induce large price swings. Apparently, the SRCCL's reasoning is that changes in climate will decrease yields and thus supply, raising prices. But the profound difficulties in modeling supply and demand are compounded by the uncertainties in climate projections, and there are many factors beyond climate that affect supply. But let's put all that aside and take the key finding at face value. The median projected price increase is 7.6% by 2050. Or an average of about 0.25% per year. We'll go a step further, however, and take the highest projection offered by any of the models, 23% over the next 3 decades, or an average of about 0.75% per year. What would be the impact of that sort of price increase? Figure 9.3 shows a 50-year history of corn and wheat prices. You can see that inflation-adjusted prices grew by a factor of 2 during the 1970s, and have been on a downward trend since, suggesting there's a lot more than a change in climate influencing prices. And there are substantial ups and downs over few-year periods that are much larger than any projected climate-related increases over the next 3 decades. In other words, even if they came to pass, climate impacts would hardly be apparent. To sum up, agricultural yields, and the food supply overall have surged during the past century, even as the globe has warmed. 2020 saw record high grain production. The IPCC assesses that whatever climate changes occurred between 1981 and 2010 had minimal impact on that strong growth. Projected price impacts of future human-induced climate changes through 2050 are not only uncertain, but also much smaller than past variations, and so should hardly be noticeable amid ordinary market dynamics. In short, the science says that crop failures because of climate are yet another apocalypse that ain't. In 2018, on the day after Thanksgiving, Black Friday, the second volume of the Fourth National Climate Assessment, NCA 2018, was released. It deals with the projected impacts of human-induced climate change, and it immediately generated the now familiar headlines warning of impending economic disaster. Among them, climate change will wallop the U.S. economy, NBC News. Climate report warns of grim economic consequences, Fox News. Climate change could cost U.S. billions, Financial Times. U.S. climate report warns of damaged environment and shrinking economy, New York Times. Indeed, key message 2 of the report's chapter 29 reads, "In the absence of more significant global mitigation efforts, climate change is projected to impose substantial damages on the U.S. economy, human health, and the environment. Under scenarios with high emissions and limited or no adaptation, annual losses in some sectors are estimated to grow to hundreds of billions of dollars by the end of the century." Both the key message and the heated headlines greatly dismayed me. They're clearly intended to be frightening. Yet I had studied the issue and knew that the projected net economic impacts were minimal. Let me explain. I first looked into the economic impacts of climate change the year before, in 2017, when one of the world's largest investment organizations requested my advice on climate science. Since they'd asked that I cover economic impacts, I had carefully read what the UN's Fifth Assessment Report, AR5, had to say on the matter. Projections of the economic impacts of a changing climate are highly uncertain. Of course, we already know there are great uncertainties in how the climate will change because of inadequate climate models and uncertainty in future emissions, and climate uncertainties are larger at the regional level than they are at the global level. For example, for the first 5 or 6 years of the recent California drought, many climate scientists said that human influences on the climate increased the risk of drought. Yet it took only about a year after the drought broke dramatically in 2016 for papers to appear claiming that a warming world would also mean a wetter California. Perhaps this is just the process of scientific understanding being refined. Less charitably, I get the distinct sense that the science is unsettled enough that any unusual weather can be attributed to human influences. In addition, climate is only one of many factors influencing economic development and well-being. Economic policies, trade, technology, and governance are also important, and these are different in different countries and can change in unpredictable ways. Economic measures are highly regional, and their future uncertainties are compounded by the uncertainty of regional climate predictions. It is particularly difficult to predict how and how much a rising temperature would damage a society economically in the face of so many unknowns, among them the role that might be played by adaptation measures, like the raising of seawalls, or shifts in what crops are cultivated that minimize, or sometimes even exploit, the impact of climate changes. Despite those challenges, the AR5's Working Group 2, whose part of the assessment is devoted to the ecological and societal impacts of the changes in climate outlined by Working Group 1, does say something about how world economic activity would be affected by a warming globe. Figure 9.4 plots some 20 published estimates showing that the, by now familiar, projected global temperature rise of up to 3 degrees Celsius by 2100 would negatively impact the global economy by, wait for it, 3% or less. For my talk to the investors, I provided some important context that was missing from the UN report. An impact of 3% in 2100, some 80 years from now, translates to a decrease in the annual growth rate by an average of 3% divided by 80, or about 0.04% per year. The IPCC scenarios, discussed in Chapter 3, Assume an average global annual growth rate of about 2% through 2100. The climate impact would then be a 0.04% decrease in that 2% growth rate, for a resulting growth rate of 1.96%. In other words, the UN report says that the economic impact of human-induced climate change is negligible, at most a bump in the road. In fact, the first point in the executive summary to its Chapter 10 is, for most economic sectors, the impact of climate change will be small relative to the impacts of other drivers, medium evidence, high agreement. Changes in population, age, income, technology, relative prices, lifestyle, regulation, governance, and many other aspects of socioeconomic development will have an impact on the supply and demand of economic goods and services that is large relative to the impact of climate change. A 2018 article written by one of the IPCC's coordinating lead authors reviewed a further 4 years of published papers and came to a similar conclusion. The total economic impacts of climate change are negative, but modest on average, and that the severe impacts on less developed countries are caused primarily by poverty. The consensus on the minimal overall economic impact of rising temperatures is well known to experts, though it's an inconvenient one for those wishing to sound the alarm on climate. I was dumbfounded when I asked a prominent environmental policymaker about the UN assessment, and the response was, "Yes, it's unfortunate that the impact numbers are so small." At any rate, this background left me primed to weigh in on the breathless coverage that accompanied the release of Volume 2 of NCA 2018. The last figure in that report's last chapter, reproduced in Figure 9.5, is based on a 2017 paper published in Science magazine. It shows that projected direct damages to the U.S. economy at the end of the century grow with increasing global average temperature, shown as the anomaly relative to the 1980 to 2010 average. As in the IPCC projection for the world economy, the impacts on the U.S. are small. A very large warming of 5 degrees Celsius, 9 degrees Fahrenheit, at the end of the century would diminish the U.S. economy by 4%. It's worth noting that this 5 degrees Celsius warming is relative to today's temperatures, which are up 1 degree Celsius from pre-industrial values, making this equal to 6 degrees Celsius of warming by the Paris Agreement accounting, which has set 1.5 degrees Celsius as a goal. Like the UN report, NCA 2018 fails to put this in context, but I can do so quite simply. The U.S. economy has grown at an average annual rate of 3.2% since 1930. It's almost 20 times larger now than it was 90 years ago. Under the conservative assumption that annual economic growth will average 2% for the next 70 years, the U.S. economy will be 4 times larger in 2090 than it is today. The purported climate impact of 4% in 2090, then, corresponds to 2 years of growth. In other words, an additional warming of 5 degrees Celsius, 9 degrees Fahrenheit, by 2090 would delay the growth of the U.S. economy to that time, 70 years from now, by only 2 years. Figure 9.6 makes that point graphically. Notice the bunching of the three curves. One curve shows that, absent any climate impact, a U.S. economy growing at the assumed 2% average annual rate would see the GDP rise from today's $20 trillion to $80 trillion in 2090. Another assumes a warming of 5 degrees Celsius, which according to NCA 2018 would produce a slightly delayed growth curve, 4% less in 2090 than it would be otherwise. Finally, there's the curve for a warming of 7.2 degrees Celsius, 13 degrees Fahrenheit, a level of warming well beyond what's projected under even the most extreme IPCC scenario. According to NCA 2018, this would result in a 10% hit between now and 2090, which still amounts to only a 5-year delay in growth 70 years from now. Within a few hours of the NCA 2018's release on Black Friday, I had drafted a short op-ed saying more or less what I have said here, which the Wall Street Journal published online on Monday. The next day, a prominent U.S. energy economist sent an email thanking me for making the point. Alas, that person could never express that thanks publicly. The next week, one of the authors of the original 2017 research paper from which the estimates used in the assessment report were drawn expressed dismay at the way their results were portrayed in the media. The climate science establishment, most notably the authors of NCA 2018, reacted to my op-ed with silence. They did nothing to address the media's catastrophizing. Perhaps they were embarrassed by their own doom-mongering. Or perhaps, like the policymaker I mentioned earlier who wished the impact numbers had been greater, it was precisely the coverage they'd been hoping for. As you've no doubt noticed yourself, the notion of climate-related economic disaster remains alive and well in the media and political dialogue. Economics has been called the dismal science, and I once joked to a prominent economist that the compounding of climate and economic projections is a doubly dismal enterprise. It is reasonable to expect that factors related to climate changes, including shifts in agricultural conditions or variations in storm patterns, will have different economic impacts and benefits on certain populations and economic sectors. Yet contrary to popular belief, even the official assessment reports indicate that significant human-induced climate change would have negligible net economic impact on either the world or the U.S. economies by the end of this century. It's clear that media, politicians, and often the assessment reports themselves blatantly misrepresent what the science says about climate and catastrophes. Those failures indict the scientists who write and too casually review the reports, the reporters who uncritically repeat them, the editors who allow that to happen, the activists and their organizations who fan the fires of alarm, and the experts whose public silence endorses the deception. The constant repetition of these and many other climate fallacies turns them into accepted truths. Over the course of this book, we've explored the chasm between what is presented as settled when it comes to climate and what the science actually tells us. So how did we get here? The next chapter will look more closely at the perfect storm of interests that leads to a fervent belief in a consensus that isn't. 10. Who broke the science and why? If crucial parts of the science really are unsettled, as we've seen over the past chapters, why is the narrative of the science so different? Can it really be that the multiplicity of stakeholders in climate matters, scientists, scientific institutions, activists and NGOs, the media, politicians, are all contributing to misinformation in the service of persuasion? And why has the science gained such prominence over science? Observing this scene over the years, I've given a lot of thought to how the communication of climate science works. I'm no expert on human behavior, but I have seen this process up close. And my direct experiences, along with some universal truths about humans, suggest not some secret cabal, but rather a self-reinforcing alignment of perspectives and interests. Let's look at the most important players in turn. The media. When I moved to the UK in 2004, I naturally began reading the British newspapers. I was struck by how much more international coverage there was than in the US. No doubt because the smaller UK necessarily has more foreign interactions, as well as ties to the rest of Europe and historical relationships with Commonwealth countries once part of the British Empire. And of course, soccer, that is, football, got many more column inches. But what surprised me most wasn't only a matter of content, but tone. The British papers were often overtly partisan, not just in their editorials, but also in their reporting. Although I'd read widely among U.S. national newspapers, including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post, it was a revelation to see the stark differences in what was covered and how it was covered among the UK's Guardian, the London Times, the Telegraph, and the Financial Times. In the years since, U.S. media outlets have developed more explicit and more differentiated points of view themselves, and those have likewise seeped from their editorial pieces into their reporting. Most notably, as the age of the internet advanced, headlines became more provocative to encourage clicks, even when the article itself didn't support the provocation. Today, the shift toward the alarming and shareable has traveled well beyond the headlines. That's especially true in climate and energy matters. Whatever its noble intentions, news is ultimately a business, one that in this digital era increasingly depends upon eyeballs in the form of clicks and shares. Reporting on the scientific reality that there's been hardly any long-term change in extreme weather doesn't fit the ethos of, if it bleeds, it leads. On the other hand, there is always an extreme weather story somewhere in the world to support a sensational headline. Changes in staffing also contribute to the media miscommunication of the science. Many newsrooms are shrinking, and serious in-depth reporting is becoming less common. Many people reporting on climate don't have a background in science. This is a particular problem because, as we've seen, the assessment reports themselves can be misleading, especially to non-experts. Science stories are almost always stories of nuance. They require time and research. Unfortunately, the pace of the news cycle has only become more frantic, and reporters and editors have less time than ever. The diversity and ubiquity of modern media have increased the demand for fresh content and the competition to be the first to post a story. And as with scientists, a professional code that calls for lack of bias doesn't mean none creeps in. As I interact with journalists, I realize that, for some, climate change has become a cause and a mission to save the world from destruction by humans, so that packing alarm into whatever the story is becomes the right thing to do, even an obligation. This has been compounded by the rise of a new job category, climate reporters. Their mission is largely predetermined. If they don't have a narrative of doom to report, they won't get into the paper, whether digital or print, or on the air. Here's an example. A recent front-page story in the Washington Post reported that the Biden administration's climate policy would aim to rapidly shrink the nation's carbon emissions, explaining that a warming planet has made the issue increasingly hard to ignore as the litany of climate-related catastrophes has grown with each passing year. Of course, as you have already read, the data does not at all support that climate-related catastrophes are growing with each passing year. There's much factual reporting in the full-page story that follows about plans for the new administration. But without those initial alarm bells, would the story have made it to the front page? In short, the general lack of knowledge of what the science actually says, the drama of extreme weather events and their heart-rending impact on people, and pressures within the industry all work against balanced coverage in the popular media. Politicians.